If you're a regular listener of this show or other shows on CJSF, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us about what you like and why you like it, as well as ways we can improve our programming. To leave comments, please email cjsfprog@sfu.ca or call 778-782-4423. This information can also be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Underrepresented music, local voices, and real people. You keep CJSF independent.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, CKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. And featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we reveal why rent control's good, actually, on Seriously Wrong, discuss ways the climate movement can be more inclusive on Pullback, and explain why solution-focused energy reporting's becoming more important than ever on the Sierra Club's The Environment in Canada. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by the new Between the Lines books release, Strangely Friends, A History of Cuban-Canadian Encounters, from Kingston-based scholar Karen Dubinsky. Drawing on her expertise as a historian and interviewer, Dubinsky takes readers beyond the realm of state politics and career politicians to reveal the complex, messy, and moving friendships that have developed between everyday Cubans and Canadians over the better part of a century. From the early days of the Cuban Revolution to the present, the book uncovers the stories of Canadians who were drawn to Cuba, teachers, artists, development aid workers, filmmakers, and activists who left an indelible mark on the island, and Cubans who found a home in Canada. Founded in 1977, Between the Lines publishes nonfiction books that expose and challenge oppression in Canadian society. Find your copy of Strangely Friends, A History of Cuban-Canadian Encounters at btlbooks.com. And this episode is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, the MB Media Co-op in Moncton, The Independent in St. John's, plus national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 23 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at Unrigged. And this episode of Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by the Alberta Advantage Podcast. Based in Calgary, this collective of more than 20 activists, academics, and journalists have been broadcasting award-winning political commentary, news, and analysis since 2017. On this excerpt from a January 2021 episode, the team take a historical deep dive into the long-forgotten story of how a small group of waffle-aligned activists managed to briefly take over the New Brunswick NDP in 1971. Now, here's the show.
Imagine if you'd never experienced the joys of an NDP convention. Come on. What would your life be like? You'd die never knowing that joy.
I mean, I'd probably have other hobbies.
Makes no difference where I go, you're the best hometown.
The Alberta Advantage is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Check out our partner shows at harbingermedianetwork.com. This independent listener-supported podcast is possible thanks to listeners like you. If you think what we do is important, support us with a monthly donation at patreon.com/AlbertaAdvantage.
Calgary, you know we love you.
Hello and welcome to the Alberta Advantage. As part of our effort to establish an Alberta Advantage for every province, today's episode will be examining New Brunswick's political history. I am your host, Kate Jacobson, and joining Team Advantage today, we have Roberta.
Hello.
Rory.
Hi there.
And our new Brunswick correspondent, Abram Lutz, who is an organizer with CUPE and graduate student at the Institute of Political Economy at Carleton. Abram, welcome to Team Advantage.
Thanks for having me.
So New Brunswick just had a provincial election. How did that go? And can you give us a sense of what is going on in New Brunswick, especially for us folks in Alberta that may not have a lot of context?
The short of it is it did not go well. The New Brunswick NDP just had its worst showing since the NDP first ran in a New Brunswick provincial election in 1962.
So quite dismal. And of course, correct me if I'm wrong here, but doesn't the Irving family, who for the record is Canada's eighth wealthiest family, ranked 13th in terms of most extensive land ownership globally, the largest private landowner in Maine and the fifth largest private landowner in America, seem like, oh, I don't know, the perfect kind of capitalist villain to mount a left populist campaign against?
Yeah, that's all true. In addition to that, they also profit directly from the carnage being wrought in Yemen currently as they purchase and refine Saudi oil for sale in the Canadian market. So all around genuine supervillains. And yet we don't really see a strong left challenge to their more or less complete dominance over the province's politics and media and general society.
So I'm going into this episode with the understanding that New Brunswick is essentially a feudal kingdom slash fiefdom that is owned and run by the Irvings. And to understand, I think, the state of the left in New Brunswick electorally and also otherwise, it's perhaps useful to take a look at the history of the electoral left in New Brunswick. So the NDP had one seat in New Brunswick for a few stretches of time. From 1982 to 87, they held one seat. And then from 1991 to 2006, they held a single seat in the electoral district of St. John Harbour. They first ran a full slate of candidates in 1970, and if you look further back, the CCF managed to get 11% of the popular vote in 1944, 6% in 1948, and 1% in 1952. They never won any seats.
So I guess we should talk a little bit about the waffle, since that's what we want to talk about today, mostly in the New Brunswick context. And we've done an episode before on the waffle more broadly, but we want to talk specifically about New Brunswick. So we'll talk a little bit first about what it was doing centrally, really in Ontario, and then what it was doing regionally in New Brunswick at the time. So the waffle, also known as the Movement for an Independent Socialist Canada, was a new left movement in the late 1960s and early 1970s that sought to turn the Social Democratic NDP into a radical socialist party. It was notable for its socialist and nationalist politics, described in the Manifesto for an Independent Socialist Canada, also known as the Waffle Manifesto, where it singled out the predominance of American foreign ownership and American culture as the principal obstacle to building socialism and to national unity in Canada. So they argued that socialism could unify French and English Canadians. It would give them a common platform, and it would help protect an independent nation. It was led by Mel Watkins and by James and Robert Laxer, as well as many others, but most of them were Ontario-based activists and organizers. There was also a very strong contingent in Saskatchewan, and someday maybe we'll do an episode on that. But the Saskatchewan contingent managed to actually have quite a bit of influence at the provincial level and really did have a say in a lot of political platforms at the time.
So the interesting thing about the waffle in New Brunswick is it actually managed to briefly take over the NDP there, which then led to the party getting suspended. But before we get really into that, we'll talk a little bit about kind of the history of the CCF and the NDP in New Brunswick up until the waffle takes it over in 1971. Basically, the CCF has generally struggled east of Ontario, with the exception of one riding in the Cape Breton coalfields. In New Brunswick, the CCF was hampered by a pretty anti-labor political atmosphere and a powerful liberal political machine that mostly dominated the province until 1970. The party was also really small and broke, which meant it wasn't really able to reach a lot of like potential supporters. So after the formation of the CCF in 1933, a New Brunswick section was founded on June 23rd, 1933. The province, particularly the north, had some of the poorest and most underdeveloped regions in the country, which the CCF thought would make fertile ground for building the party. However, organized labor was also quite weak in New Brunswick, and it didn't affiliate with the new party either. So in the 1939 provincial election, 6 years after they had formed, they ran a single candidate who did not win.
I would just want to say that it's worth noting that the general neglect of the CCF in New Brunswick is reflective of a broader trend within East Coast and maritime left politics. So even the more radical left-wing organizations active at the time, for example, the Communist Party largely didn't have a presence in New Brunswick because of the repressive labor environment, but also many of these organizations were broke. So they, for very prudent fiscal reasons, often focused on Cape Breton because it was sort of the nuclei of labor activity in the Maritimes and didn't branch out very much because of material restraints.
So looking at the 1939 provincial election, the New Brunswick CCF ran a single candidate who didn't win. And quite concerned with the New Brunswick wing of the party, the National CCF sent one of its Saskatchewan MPs, George Castleton, to help with organizing for the 1944 provincial election. And he reported that CCF penetration politically was very uneven throughout the province and quite weak overall. Where they did best were urban areas, industries that had significant unionization, and areas with strong cooperative movement. This is sort of where the party did best, but they really struggled with rural areas where they had little support. And this is a really big contrast to the CCF in Ontario and Saskatchewan and the prairies more generally, where they tended to draw their support from rural areas that had strong cooperative movements. And that goes to what Abram was saying about Cape Breton kind of being a nuclei for radical politics and for left politics, for these kind of nascent left parties or movements. And as, you know, the CCF's national fortunes rose in the mid-1940s, some of that basically spilled over into New Brunswick. And in the 1944 provincial election, the CCF runs in 41 out of 48 seats. They capture 11% of the vote and 25% in both St. John and in Moncton. However, despite this relative success, they were shut out of the legislature. The Liberals won another majority, and they basically chalk this failure to win seats up to kind of a continuing lack of organization, which has been a theme throughout the CCF in New Brunswick, and also not sufficiently distinguishing their platform from the Liberals, who are promising an expansive post-war reconstruction program. And we know also that the CCF and a lot of left hypotheses on what would happen post-war really struggle in this era, because there was kind of a common understanding on the left in Canada at the time that after the, you know, relative success of planning during the Second World War, that the return to the free market economy would lead to basically a massive recession, or at least to major gaps in how the post-war state would be organized. But of course, the post-war state was actually very successful in kind of brokering that famous peace between labor and capital, and also sort of constructing a new type of constituent out of some of those previously radical groups. So I think it's really important to talk about the ways that, you know, the post-war compromise was based around an ideal type of worker, white, male, supporting a family, a settler, and that it not only was based around that person, but it also constituted it, you know, and it made that a very specific kind of political force and program that had access to certain mechanisms of the state. And that threw a huge wrench in how leftists in Canada talked about the economy and talked about the post-war economy.
On the post-war reconstruction, particular to New Brunswick, it was kind of the first time that both federal and provincial governments really invested in developing the province's economy. Basically, once the forestry booms dried up and the shipping industry in St. John was no longer a key node in the British imperial logistics of their capitalist empire, the New Brunswick was largely left to rot up until the post-war reconstruction. And so this created a general sense of optimism and upsurge that meant that people in New Brunswick didn't really feel as inclined to radical politics, whereas the underdevelopment prior to the Second World War probably would have made some of the inequalities in the province more apparent. Although this reconstruction obviously had mixed results for workers, while it was a general improvement in living standards through, for example, the electrification of the province for the very first time through the creation of the public power utility, it also meant the breaking up of some very organic working class communities in major centers like St. John. Urban renewal basically took dense communities and broke them up into suburbs, effectively breaking a lot of longstanding organic cultural ties between the industrial working class and those centers.
So there were these structural factors that went into the CCF largely being shut out in the 1944 provincial election and in subsequent elections as well. But there was also some kind of out and out, you know, red baiting threats, things like that. So employers would threaten termination for those who were seen as affiliated with the CCF. And there are many towns in New Brunswick at this time that are essentially company owned. Media also ran a really massive red baiting campaign against the CCF during the election. Although this, of course, was not particularly uncommon for the CCF elsewhere in the country. Now, despite winning no seats, the New Brunswick CCF was fairly optimistic that after the election that they could do better next time. But the next election actually turned out to be a big step backwards. In 1948, the party was unable to pay for a secretary. It ended up being someone who was volunteering her time. They ran only 20 candidates out of 52 ridings. They didn't even contest seats where they had done best in 1944. They got 6% of the vote overall and no seats. And like I said earlier, this is a decline that continued with each election. So in 1952, when the Liberals were defeated, the CCF got only 1.6% of the vote. They ran no candidates in 56, 60, or 63, and only three candidates were run in 1967 for a 0.1% vote share. So this 1944 provincial election, which isn't really all that impressive, is a real high mark for the CCF in New Brunswick.
Well, and I think we can see this broadly with the CCF during this time, that there's really a surge that happens kind of 1943 through to 1945, nationally and provincially across the country. But just quickly thereafter, as was discussed in terms of post-war reconstruction, the adoption of a lot of CCF policies like economic planning and a social welfare state.
That was the Alberta Advantage. Find out more about the show at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. This episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by the new Between the Lines books release, Strangely Friends, A History of Cuban-Canadian Encounters. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2014, Vancouver-based Seriously Wrong is a bi-weekly utopian leftist comedy podcast featuring co-hosts Aaron and Sean and guests in conversations exploring themes like the justice system, airplane food, and more, like on this excerpt from a recent episode explaining why that ghastly boogeyman that haunts the dreams of housing economists and landlords alike, rent control, is good, actually. Now, here's the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Real Economics Tough Talk podcast. We are your egghead bean counting experts who always figure out the real truth, whether or not the populist left lunatics, well-meaning as they are, like it in their fits of incompetence and malice.
You know, I can't even blame them, because in economics, a lot of times there's some really counterintuitive findings that just aren't obvious on the surface. You got to dig a little deeper, look at the numbers and say, okay, you know, rent control. Sure, on the surface of it, people who live in rent-controlled apartments have more stability, they're paying lower rents, but if you dig a little bit deeper underneath that, what's really going on?
Yeah, unintended consequences.
There's a lot of unintended consequences.
The beauty of rent control, it's skin deep, you know? It's like the beautiful cheerleader of housing, but you get to know her and you find out, oh, she's actually quite mean to waitstaff.
That's a perfect analogy, yeah.
You know, people would hang a photograph of rent control on their wall as part of a misogynistic attitude.
So, you know, the first thing is that people who advocate for rent control, they're often focused on the renters and what's good for the renters. And they're not focused on the other people in this equation.
Right.
The landlords.
Yeah, I mean, often if landlords, whether a big landlord or a small landlord or a very, very teensy tiny small and extremely innocent landlord.
Pocket size.
They're often not brought into the conversation about property and housing economics and rent control. And to the degree that they are, they're brought in as a villain, an enemy image. you know, a way for people to externalize their own insecurities around maybe their productivity or other personal things in their life.
Put yourself in their shoes a little bit. You're a landlord. You want a home that you don't live in, and you want the tenant who does live in it to pay your mortgage for you, pay the interest on your mortgage for you, pay the property taxes for you. You get to own the asset.
Maintenance costs.
Pay for maintenance costs, yeah. Obviously. And then a little bit of money, extra... Yeah. Spending, but you want to make a bit of a profit.
Well, you're a business person.
It,
you're not
right?
doing this, you know.
It's got to be something in it for you as
if they
well.
Don't, if so. They don't have walking around money on top of the asset purchase, on top of the purchases of all the things mm-hmm. that you've mentioned.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, why is an investor going to choose to invest there in housing, something we desperately need, when there might be an alternative to invest in weapons technology or right. surveillance technology?
Right. So are you a villain for that? Are you a villain for wanting a good economic opportunity? I don't think so.
I mean, villains belong in storybooks. In the real world, everyone's fighting their own struggle.
Yeah, that's so true. It's so true.
And I think if a lot of these tenant advocates took 10 minutes to get to know these landlords, they would say, raise my rent.
If you're not dehumanizing them, you would see.
Yeah. It's like they live glasses except for bureaucracy, red tape, government overreach, and scraping away at profit margins.
The ironic thing, too, about rent control is that, you know, a lot of people who hate landlords see it as chains that only restrict landlords. But actually, rent control are chains that restrict tenants as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, society as such.
A lot of tenants who live in rent-controlled apartments are like, oh, this apartment is so cheap, I'm going to keep living here. To keep paying this cheap rent, I'm going to choose that because it's better for me to not pay higher rent.
Yeah.
So,
but at what real cost?
They're basically just locked in. They can never move.
They'll miss opportunities to get housing that may be closer to their workplace or maybe closer to amenities they more frequently use.
Or that's in a neighborhood they can actually afford.
Right. And so you have the situation where they're locked in by these low rents. And as a result, rent control kind of tricks them and misguides them and prevents them from moving to higher rent apartments that may be a better fit for them. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, they're robbed of that freedom because instead, you know, they're paying half the rent they would otherwise pay or whatever sort of fickle small mm-hmm. things
yeah,
they
yeah.
think they're getting in return as they're under the hypnotic gaze.
In a well-functioning market, renters should flow like a river. And rent control is the dam that keeps them festering in a dead. You know, dams are bad because they prevent flow, and that's just like rent control.
It is, yeah. And I mean, the sad thing is, although this is thought to be a way to make things more affordable for people, in many cases, tenants in rent-controlled properties actually could afford to pay more money to their landlord. Kind of goes against the spirit of alleviating inequality, right? Because the purpose of this is to, I mean, if you listen to advocates, is to make sure that everyone, regardless of income, pays the highest amount of income that they can afford.
That's what affordable means, and that's what we all should want.
Yeah, and it increases inequality because you have, and now I've got papers from that show this, a very famous paper from San Francisco that's often cited mentions this. It actually increases inequality by keeping poor and often minority families in neighborhoods that they would have been displaced from, causing there to be a larger gap between them and the rich newcomers than there would otherwise be if it was all newcomers and they'd been displaced. This is a real thing. You know, for the Occupy Wall Street set, I thought you were trying to decrease economic inequality, not increase it.
Yeah, exactly. Hello, a bit of logic, please.
Put down the bong for 5 minutes and read some of this housing economics.
Another thing that they don't think about, if it's not profitable for landlords to rent out buildings, they might sell those buildings out of the rental market
yeah.
to people who are going to buy them and then live in them themselves and not right. rent them out. Where does that leave renters with less supply?
Yeah,
it's horrible.
It's a handout. By definition, it's a handout to homeowners when
right.
anytime you have a conversion like that. And the rental market getting tightened by that, or if, God forbid, a renter becomes a homeowner, they're losing the sacred status of renter. I mean, the very thing that tenant advocates want to protect.
Right.
You're effectively killing one of them. Like, there's one less tenant to protect.
Yeah.
You killed them. Your policies killed them.
Because now they're a property owner. Now, yeah, they're your enemy.
What are we going to do next? Help the poor by making them no longer poor anymore?
Who will be left to help? What
exactly
are you talking about?
But the whole point is helping the poor. If they're not poor, you can't help them. It just doesn't make any logical
sense.
Become
it's
economically illiterate.
We are the 98.7% because we brought 0.3% more people into... No, what are you talking about?
Ruining slogans too,
Put
yeah.
down the bong.
In Cambridge, Massachusetts, they actually got rid of rent control that they had had for a long time, and studies found that crime decreased in those areas by 16%.
Right. This connects to the inequality piece, is that all of the poor people have been pushed out of the neighborhood, making the crime disappear entirely from the world.
Yeah, exactly. It's like if we just raised rents all around the world and all the poor people were pushed out,
you could bring crime down to zero.
Right down to zero.
So if we just take the rents and we double the rent, we triple the rent, and we just extrapolate on this makes a lot of sense. You extrapolate on that, you could bring down murder, assault, you could bring it all down to zero permanently. It's just that the rents aren't high enough.
Exactly. If you're paying cheap rent, you're just sitting there thinking, oh, I don't need to do anything with my life. You light a fire under that ass, you triple, quadruple, quintuple their rent, all of a sudden
they're
a productive member of society, there's no more crime. Ironically, the way to the utopia that these so-called leftist Occupy people want is through market forces. Do people feel incentivized to build new units in a system where there's controls on the amount of rent that they're going to be able to charge? No, you know, it's not going to pencil out for them. It's not going to meet their pro forma.
Yeah, and I can say, as someone involved heavily in the business community, I know these people. They are like shy little mice that you need to get cheese to come out of their little hole when it comes to building.
Investors, famously mouse-like.
Yeah, and just the housing industry writ large. I mean, everyone needs to get their cut. The banks need to get their cut. Investors need to get their cut. The developers need to get the cut. Their second round of investors need to get their cut, of course. Right. And obviously the second round of mortgage and interest payments need to get their cut. Plus the landlord at the end of the day needs to say, okay, on top of paying off the asset, what walking around money do I have? And when you add that all up, it becomes a delicate kind of snake charming game where you're charming wave after wave of snakes while at the same time trying to keep housing, I wouldn't say affordable, but moderately affordable as compared to the extreme.
That's so true. And people never think about all these snakes who are going to be negatively affected by this if you have rent control, if you can't charge what you need. And developers, landlords, banks, the investors, of course. Those investors are the people who risk the most in this situation.
For
they
sure,
put up all the risk, basically, in terms of monetary value. And investors are people too. Just put yourself in their shoes for a minute.
It shouldn't be radical to say, but it is.
Yeah.
And they're performing something. People say, oh, investors, it's unproductive labor. By definition, it's what's called economic rent, which means that it's non-productive by definition. They always say that. And it's like, well, actually, investment is a type of productivity because you're adding liquidity to the market, which means that, just to bring you through some real economics, liquidity means that things more often sell at their asking price versus selling at a reduced rate. So a market that has a lot of things selling at a reduced rate is an illiquid market, which is bad because it means you can't predict what the prices of things are.
Yeah, you want things to be liquid, flowing, again, not damn it up with low prices.
You don't want to store it in amber like Jurassic Park,
Yeah. We also saw how that turned out.
Basically, liquid means that it's a seller's market instead of a buyer's market. Because in a buyer's market, buyers can bid lower and get those prices. That's called illiquid. And if it's a seller's market and the seller can always get the price they want, that is called liquid. And the reason that investors are good, and this is a real argument from economics, cited on the Wikipedia page for investment as one of the arguments in favor of investors, is that they create liquidity, which means that sellers get higher prices from buyers, which is good. So no, it's not unproductive. It's actually quite productive in that it makes sure that prices remain high.
And it's such a shame that so many people don't understand that, don't understand basic economics, don't understand the second order effects of these things. And another major second order effect here is that if investors aren't getting their cut and decide not to build housing, what happens then to renters? And this is really the big thing here, is like the very people you're trying to protect, the one people who seemingly benefit from this, in the end, because there's such a slowdown in building, rents are going to skyrocket, especially in the non-rent controlled sector.
Yeah.
And
so that's the ironic part and the horrible part.
It's ironic, it's horrible. And the alternative to that, obviously, is you don't control the rents. The rents don't get cheaper. People build and build a lot because of the incentive provided by all the high rents. And then because they're building so much, then rents will start to slowly go down. And then they'll keep going down and keep going down, even though I said a minute ago that rents going down means the people won't build. But in this case, it's different because when rents get cheaper because of more building, people keep building. But if rents get cheaper because of rent control, they stop building.
Yeah. I mean, that's just common sense.
Yeah.
That's why supply is key. And that's what the Occupy freaks don't understand. But I wish they would pick up a book and learn. The way to decrease prices is to increase supply. And the way to increase supply is to increase prices.
So you need to increase